Hello and welcome to the Film Podcast.
Yes, this is, if you're listening to this, this is part two of our ongoing canon film series where we're kind of doing a retrospective of sorts, discussing all the films. We're going to eventually get through probably all of them.
Hopefully,
yeah. Six at a time. We're doing like four to six at a time, and hopefully in a couple of months we'll be done with all the films. I feel like we're getting closer. Once we get to the late 80s, we're going to get to, mid to late 80s, we're going to get to the really, really ones, the ones I really want to talk about, like okay. American Ninja. But tell you what, I've already discovered some gems here that I haven't, that a couple films that I hadn't seen, and I watched for the first time, and man, I was really surprised how good some of these were. So
yeah, I have to agree, not to pull the curtain back too far, but there are a couple on here that I was really blown away by.
Yeah, me too. So for the people just joining in on this episode, you could track down the first episode at thefilmpodcast.com, where we covered The Apple, New Year's Evil, Enter the Ninja, Death Wish 2. I think those were Yeah, we did four. I feel like that was a good episode. It had Brian Sauer, or Bob Freelander, as he's known on Twitter. But today it's just myself and Eric Peterson. Thanks for joining me.
And we want to send a shout out to Brian because he is off making a documentary, and that's why he's not available.
Yeah. And do you know what documentary he's making? I do.
I do.
Could you give a teaser?
A big fan. All right, he's a big fan of Danny Perry's book, The Guide for the Film Fanatic, and he's making a documentary about that.
Which I can't wait to see, because he's got some good people that are going to be on it, so I'm excited about it. And you could find him at Bob Freelander on Twitter, so check his stuff out, and his Twitter will have a link to his blog and all that stuff, so check him out. All right. Do you want to get into it or?
Sure. We can get into it.
Perfect.
So, maybe before we start, we should mention that, the films that we have skipped so far have oftentimes been because they're not available and that the films we're covering now are ones that have been available on DVD for the most part. So.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, yeah, DVD or VHS, it's much, because some of them are like out of print and are really hard to find. Like, I know the film Nana from 1982, that's hard to find. Like, I couldn't find it anywhere. So,
well, you know, I was looking at some of the ones that aren't available, and I'm surprised because they have, you know, Elliot Gould film or John Cassavetes film. And you're like, you really, seriously, there's not enough people that are fans of, these actors, or, another one is House of Long Shadows, which is like Vincent Price, Peter Cushing, Christopher Lee, and John Carradine. I mean, come on, the horror fans would eat that up.
I know. That was one of the ones where I was really excited to, when I saw the list, I'm like, oh yeah, in the second episode, we'll get to House of Long Shadows, which I'd never seen, and the preview just looks great because it's got a bunch of like masters of horror,
and it's kind of a parody too. It's an early kind of horror parody.
Yeah. So I was really excited to get to that, but then I realized, oh wow, I can't find it anywhere. So I just had to make do with the trailer, just replaying it over and over. On this episode, we're going to be talking about The Last American Virgin. We're talking about That Championship Season, Treasure of the Four Crowns, 10 to Midnight, and Hercules.
Yes.
All right, so we'll get into the first one, released in, I believe, July 30th of 1982, The Last American Virgin.
Yeah. So basically, this the 80s was the era of a certain kind of teen sex comedy / coming-of-age film. And this one's actually a remake of the Israeli film Eskimo Leman, which I've never seen. And I have read that there was a series of these films. The Israeli films were nostalgia films about the 50s. But The Last American Virgin updates the time period to Los Angeles in the early 80s. It's basically about three friends who are maybe at the end of high school, just getting out of high school, and their quest to get laid and to meet girls. And, as usually happens in these films, friendships break apart, their girl gets gets in between two guys. Not literally, that would come later in the 90s, but but figuratively in the 80s, I mean, it was still that time. And it's about the journey of these boys as their friendships kind of wax and wane, as they do when you're at that age.
Yeah, yeah. And I was really surprised by this movie. And yeah, like you mentioned, this officially is a remake of the movie you mentioned. I think the American title was Lemon Popsicle was the series. And from what I read, it was at least like six movies that they made, that they were a series of like coming of age films that took place in Israel. But and that's what they wanted to do with this one. And it was going to be the last American series. And it was going to start off with Virgin and then, you know, hopefully kind of remake all of the ones they had made, the Israeli ones they had made. But I don't think, I guess it kind of flopped and they didn't want to invest more money on the sequel. So,
which is interesting because it has become a cult film.
Yeah.
I actually watched this last week sometime and I'd seen it before. I have it as part of one of those six film, you know, 80s box set thingies that's got like Zapped and, you know, all those kinds of films in it.
Yeah.
And I had watched it before and not really been impressed. But when I watched it again, I really was, I don't know. It was just really, really engrossing. And I thought that it had a lot of heart. And it definitely wasn't the teen sex comedy romp that you might see from the title or from the cover art of the box set. Or I'm sorry, the poster of the film.
Yeah.
You know, and that's one of the things I think a lot of people forget is that a lot of those 80s teen sex comedies did have something to say about being a teenager and love and life, and definitely were not just, you know, schlock, and definitely not just TNA. Although there is plenty of that in this film.
Yeah, yeah. Well, here's the thing with this movie is I feel like it starts off as like your typical like teen sex romp, but then about just right about the halfway point, it gets really serious. And like it takes the tone, it takes a complete like turn into like really serious and really heavy. And I was totally surprised, and that was my favorite part of the movie. Even though, yeah, it was fun. The first half of the movie was really fun and like total like teen sex romp from the 80s and a lot of boobs. And a lot of these girls, I'm like, is it me or do they look a lot younger than they were? I'm like, what's going on here?
They do, but there's also something, one of the things I was thinking about was these look like real teenage girls. They don't look like, paper thin, starved, wannabe celebrity model types that we would get today.
Yeah, it doesn't look like, it's funny, I hate to bring this movie up, but it's just a blaring example of the difference between this movie and modern teenagers, is that teenagers now, they all look like Megan Fox, you know?
Yeah. And I watched The Bling Ring last night.
Oh.
And because it just came out in Blu-ray.
Yeah.
And looking at these teenagers trying to be adults, whereas it seems like in Last American Virgin, and also a lot of 80s films, whether they were about the teens in the 80s or teens in the 50s, because that was a kind of a theme in the 80s.
Yeah.
Was that these still looked like teenagers, even when you had 22, 23-year-old adults playing the teenagers.
Yeah.
That they still had some quality, whereas now it's these teenage actors or, you know, young adult actors who are, you know, carrying themselves and talking and being concerned with how they look and, you know, like somebody in like a complete narcissist in their mid-20s rather than somebody who's 16 or 17.
Yeah, yeah. It, like, a lot of these, yeah, it's funny. I want to say innocent, but it's not. I mean, a lot of these 80s films, it was mostly about getting laid for the guys in the movies. And now, like, it's totally shifted as to what teenagers want in film, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, definitely these kids look like normal kids as opposed to, you know, young 20-year-olds playing 16-year-olds. I do have to mention the writer director of The Last American Virgin is actually the writer director of the Israeli film, Eskimo Lemon. And it is Bose Davison, who I believe now is the head of Millennium Films. He's one of the executives of Millennium Films, if I'm not mistaken. And yeah, this movie starts off really, it starts off really funny and like lighthearted. I like the trio. It's kind of, it's an like 80s version of like Superbad.
Well, I was thinking American Pie, but yeah.
That too. Yeah, yeah, totally. We're just, it's just dudes trying to get laid and they're not, I don't even know if these guys are popular or not. They really don't. No. I guess they're not the jocks. So
have you ever seen a film called Joysticks?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay, it's about this video arcade, and it's about this group of like three or four guys that are friends.
Yeah.
And once again, they're trying to get laid, and there's really cool video games and punk rockers. That's what this reminded me of, this group.
Yeah, totally, totally.
Well, that's the other thing is that this group felt a little more amorphous than what you would see now, where you'd have the popular one and the rich one. And, they didn't feel like the kids were put in these molds of, you know, this guy is this fits into this mold. You know, it wasn't like central casting cliche of we need the cool teen and, you know, we need the smart kid and we need the rich kid kind of a thing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the group was the group of the three kids, which is Gary, Rick, and who's the third guy? Is it David, right?
Yeah.
Gary, Rick, and David, they're all very, and even the characters themselves are very different, you know? Like, one's, yeah, like, the really cocky guy, and one's the guy who's not sure of himself, and then the other guy's, like, the chubby guy.
The comic relief. Yeah, you know,
he was really funny, actually. I was totally surprised by his performance. And it was just, like, a really fun movie, and then, for me, if anybody has listened to some of the podcasts we've done previously, I love sad movies. I love sad stuff. And the ending to this.
Like, yeah, I was watching it and I was just like, oh my God. It's not just the what's the right way to say this without giving away the ending. I would say that it's what a coming of age movie should show is somebody grew up.
Yeah, yeah. And for the listeners that are listening to it now, and here we go. This podcast you're listening to is enhanced. So if you don't want any spoilers, because we're going to definitely get into spoilers with all these movies, you could just forward, just hit like next chapter on your iPhone or iTunes or whatever you're listening to on, and it'll go to the next movie, which is, what's the next movie? The championship?
That championship season.
That championship season. So that way you don't get anything spoiled and, you know, you can come back and just listen to that part if you need to. But yeah, so we're going to get into spoilers. So if you haven't seen this or, you know,
this sounds interesting to you. And I would say that if you like Valley Girl or Fast Times at Ridgemont High or American Pie or Superbad, this is something that's worth looking at. If you're somebody who grew up in the 80s and want to see, you know, want to take that little trip back and see fashions and, you know, what the streets of LA look like and that kind of thing, it's really worth your time.
Yeah, yeah. So here we go. Let's officially get into spoilers.
Okay.
And you know what was really cool about this movie, and from what I see, it's I think I just saw the new movie by Audrey Plaza, where it takes place in the '80s.
Okay, is that the called To-Do List?
Yes, To-Do List.
Which I do want to see because she's adorable.
Yeah, no, she is, and she's really good in that. And in that movie, they're kind of replicating this time period, but there's nothing like this time period. Like, as soon as the movie starts, you're like, oh wow, like everything tries to be this, but I don't know why they haven't cracked the '80s. I think because they're always trying to make fun of it instead of embracing that, hey, we had this weird time period, you know, where
I think I know. And let me just say that I grew up in the '80s and, you know, I was born in 1972. So I was, 8 to 18 in the eighties, 8 to 18 in the '80s. So I was a teenager through the majority of the '80s. And what works in this movie to capture that time period is that it's, these kids aren't super wealthy. They're not driving, you know, the slick cars. They don't have every single, you know, fashionable piece of clothing. It's kind of makeshift, you know, so you got the jean jacket, you put the collar up, but it doesn't have to be like the designer brand.
Yeah.
You know, they don't, this has a great soundtrack, by the way, which I'm sure we'll talk about, but too many 80s films fall into that ooh, if we just play that Bananarama song, because then, you know, wink, you know, that's the signal that it's the 80s.
Yeah.
But too many, they get it a little too perfect, and that's what's off, is the 80s was not perfect. It was all kind of an amalgam of what had come before that was being reprocessed into what was now during the 80s. And when they try to replicate it, it's a little too spot on, I think, is what it is.
Yeah, you know what? Yes, you kind of hit it right on the nail right on the head. I had actually heard a Q&A with Tom Ford. He did a movie with Colin Firth. And it's the same time period as Mad Men. And I noticed that he talked a lot about that. He's like, when you watch Mad Men, and by the way, I love Mad Men. It's probably one of my favorite shows on TV right now. Everything's new. There's nothing worn. There's nothing used. But then when you see Tom Ford's movie, he's like, just because we're setting these films in a certain time period, they own stuff prior to that time period. So not everything has to be new. Things could be worn. Things could be old. So he's like, we make sure we incorporate things from a decade before. And that's what these movies that take place in the 80s incorporate, that, you know, the car they're driving, it's like a 70s station wagon, you know, it's an old car. And you're right, like, these teenagers weren't rich, you know, the lead, I guess you'd call him, Gary, he drives around his work car. He's a pizza delivery boy, and he drives around this station wagon with a huge advertising thing on top of the car. This like statue of the pizza place he works at, and it's bright pink, by the way.
Yeah, it's ugly. It's hideous.
Yeah.
But it's in line with, you know, if you think about something like Can't Buy Me Love, where the main character is driving around in his father's station wagon with the business sign on the side. You know, I want to say that John Cusack does the same thing in Better Off Dead.
Yeah,
the car he gets to drive is, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm watching The Lost American Virgin, and I'm like, oh wow, I wonder what year Losing It came out with Tom Cruise and Jackie Earle Haley, because it kind of had a similar vibe, you know, and it literally came out the next year. But I was surprised that Losing It wasn't a Canon Film production. So,
well, you know, and that's actually on that same set that I have.
Losing Oh, really? Well, it was all distributed by MGM, but different production companies. But Lost American Virgin. It just starts off really fun. It's about, you know, Gary, Rick, and Dave trying to get laid. That's basically it. They hang out at places where teenagers would hang out, you know, a pizza place, at a hamburger place.
Exactly.
And Gary's kind of in love with this girl named Karen, who's played by Diane Franklin.
Who's probably best known from Better Off Dead as the French exchange student.
Exactly. And she's great in this. She's really great.
Oh, yeah.
And I didn't recognize her right away. And I'm like, this girl looks so familiar, but I don't recognize where she's from. And then I looked at IMDb'd her, and I'm like, oh, there. That's what it is, Better Off Dead. and Gary, Rick, and David kind of get involved in all these, like, sexcapades.
Yeah.
They eventually meet up. Gary delivers to this like older Latin lady, Carmela, and they all get to sleep with her except Gary, and that's a really funny scene. And she's the only one who was kind of a little over the top for me. Everybody kind of worked for in this movie. Like, the acting was fine except for Carmela, Luisa Moritz, who plays Carmela, and she was a little over the top, but it still kind of worked and stuff. So,
well, you know, she was over the top, but I can imagine that in this period, LA, there would be, you know, this lonely housewife type that would play at that because of it, you know, being that time period and that place.
Yeah, and she's kind of also playing like a Charo type.
Yes,
so it totally works. And I'm sure they reached out to Charo, but she's like, no, I don't want to make your B movie.
At that point, she's probably like, is Love Boat still on? Okay,
yeah,
I'm good.
Yeah. And up to this point, Canon Film, all the Canon Film productions were all kind of like B movies, you know? And this was kind of, this falls into the same category. And like I said, like halfway through the movie, so all these three guys are going through all these sexcapades. They pick up three girls That was a funny scene too when they pick up those three girls, three teenagers at the burger stand, and that's also an eclectic group of girls too, because the one's a really nerdy one, and then one's like the really loose one, and that was a really good scene when they take them back to Gary's house and they're all trying to sleep with them. And
well, you know, the thing is, in the 50s version of this story, you would have had the, you know, like the sexy one with the cool guy, and you would have the nerdy girl with the nerdy guy.
Yeah.
And you would have the chunky girl with the chunky guy. But in this one, they mixed it up.
I did like that a lot, because I'm like, oh, David's going to end up with the nerdy, chubby one.
Yeah.
But he didn't. He ended up with, like, you know, a good-looking one. And I have to start – I totally forgot when we started this, talking about this film, all the great music that's in it. Well, I love the music. If you hate the 80s music, you're not going to like the soundtrack.
Here's one of the things that it gets right that so many of the films now that are set in the 80s don't. Is, you know, all right, so you got Tommy Two-Tone and The Police and Devo and Oingo Boingo and The Gleaming Spires, which if you know them from Revenge of the Nerds, that's such a great song. Are You Ready for the Sex Girls? That's a classic. But so they have all of those songs, but at the same time they got, you know, Journey and REO Speedwagon and Casey and the Sunshine Band, speaking of bringing things from the previous decade.
Yeah, yeah.
And to kind of fill out, because in the 80s you turned on your top 40 radio and you would hear new stuff like the new one from the Cars or the new one from U2. And then they would play, you know, some 70s, you know, hit like Casey, maybe not Casey and the Sunshine Band, but you know, they play some early Journey stuff or some REO Speedwagon or some Kansas or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. And then, I just felt like as soon as the movie started and like music started playing, I'm like, usually for these movies, I tend to like, I'll be like doing something else on the computer or my iPhone, you know, like, and I usually don't do that. I mean, but this one, I was like, oh, I know what this is. I felt like I knew what it was. And I'm like, oh, it's just a sex romp. I'll just kind of look up at it, you know, once in a while. But as soon as the music started, I literally put down my computer and I'm like, I can't. I got to devote my complete attention to this movie now.
Yeah, I was pretty engrossed by it, to be honest. And I was a little surprised because when I watched it before, I hadn't been.
Yeah, and of course, it's an 80s movie, so there has to be a cocaine reference at some point. And the girls that they pick up at the burger stand, they want, you know, the nerdy girl doesn't care about anything. Like, as soon as she's asked about something, she's like, I don't care. And at the end, she's like, do you guys have cocaine? And they go into the kitchen and they bring out a bunch of Sweet and Low. And all the girls snort it and, you know, they think they're really high and, you know.
It's like that Adam Sandler skit.
Yeah. And I was waiting for somebody to sneeze and blow the cocaine away, you know. That's the only thing it needed.
A little Woody Allen reference.
Yeah. And so, you know, they think they're all high and everybody kind of goes into a different part of the house with their girl. Mm-hmm. And right away, you see the first pair of boobs. Two pairs, I guess, because two of them get topless. Yep. And Gary just can't get it done. You know, he's like kind of like trying to kiss her, but she just keeps eating chips.
Yep.
which is a really great scene because he gets her shirt off from one scene to another. They never show you Gary taking off her shirt, but it's really funny because they cut to like Rick and he's like, you know, he's got his girl like naked on the bed.
Yep.
And then they cut back to Gary and she doesn't have a shirt on, but she has a bra on. And she has like chip crumbs all over her chest, and it's pretty genius. And he, you know, him trying to like cut her, like, well, take her bra off. But at the end, he grabs a pair of scissors, and then, of course, Gary's parents walk in.
Oh yeah.
And that was really fun, and I love the whole cocaine. I knew like, okay, there's got to be at some point there's gonna be cocaine in this movie. When is it gonna happen? And sure enough, like 15 minutes into the movie. but yeah, and then the next scene that really kind of made me laugh was the homoerotic dick measuring contest.
Yeah, that was like, whoa. And so the guy that is there's a fourth guy that's their geeky friend who they kind of take advantage of.
Yeah, I think his name is Victor. I think it's Victor. Yes. Yeah.
he is played by an actor named Brian Peck,
yeah.
who is most well known for being in one of my all-time top 10 films. He was one of the punks in Return of the Living Dead.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and then he's had little cameos in subsequent Return of the Living Dead films, and I guess he's done a bunch of voice work.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah.
And he's kind of like the nerd of the group. Like, yep. he's like really smart. He wears a pocket protector.
But he's kind of also the outsider. He hangs with them sometimes, and sometimes yeah. they run off and leave him, but there's kind of like he's like the fourth member of the group, but he's not part of the core.
Yeah, yeah. They always seem to take advantage of him. Stealing his car and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But yeah,
the dick measuring contest. I was like, "Whoa, I don't know if that would fly today."
so Victor, the fourth unofficial guy of the group, he's kind of more nerdy. And he's in the guy's locker room, and there's a hole, like a peephole, into the girl's locker room. And of course...
Because that never really happened
to me. Yeah, yeah.
And I lived in the 80s, I can tell you that for sure.
Well, it's funny because I watch a lot of these 80s movies, not particularly mm-hmm. this one, but, you know, in general, a bunch of 80s, like, sex romps, mm-hmm. right before I went into high school. When I went to high school, I'm like, dude, I can't wait to get into high school because there's going to be people get to see. Like in my head, that's what I thought was going to happen. Like it's just like a tradition, I guess. Every high school has a people where you go look into the girls' locker room, and I was sorely disappointed when that didn't happen.
I'll tell you something that's shocking to most people. My high school barely had locker rooms and barely had a gym.
Oh wow.
Yeah, we had the local fitness guru was our gym teacher.
Oh, really? And
so it was like running, you know, calisthenics, weightlifting. I think we played games twice a year or something. And then they had dance fitness class that a lot of people took. So.
Oh, wow. But no people in your high school either?
Not that I'm aware of. But, you know, once upon a time, my high school, you know, back in the 70s, it was a hippie high school. And by the 80s, it was a punk high school. So.
Okay. But yeah, then all the kids come into the locker room and make fun of Victor, and he suggests that, you know, he has a bigger penis than the rest of them. And I think is it Victor or Gary who suggests that they have a dick measuring contest?
Yes. And everyone puts in a dollar.
Yeah. Everybody puts in a dollar, and whoever has the biggest dick gets, you know, the whole pool, you know? And yep. I believe the game, they named the game. The game was called Biggest Tool Wins the Pool. So, and what the creepy part of this dick measuring contest is that Gary's the one measuring them. Why would yes. he hold the ruler? Like, if this was gonna happen, I'd be like, okay, every man has to bring a ruler in tomorrow. We'll cancel it for today. We'll come back tomorrow, and everyone bring their own ruler because I don't want to touch the same rulers.
Okay, so if they did this today, what they would do is they would get one of the girls to volunteer to do the measuring.
Yeah, yeah. But in this one, it was two dudes just sitting there at, like, dick level, yep. like face to dick level.
Just like measuring. A line of guys in their whitey tighties.
Yeah. Except for David, the chubby one of the group. He always wore boxers for some reason.
Because they're comfortable, that's why.
So Gary's measuring everybody. And then he gets to Rick and he laughs, like, oh, I'm measuring my friend's dick. Yeah. Like. But yeah, I thought that was a really, really like funny scene that would totally never fly nowadays.
But you are right. After all of these hijinks, it does kind of get more serious.
Yeah. So after, I think, after they meet the like horny Spanish lady, Carmelo, mm-hmm. that's when it starts getting really serious. So, Gary likes this girl, Karen, again, who's Diane Franklin. And she actually likes Rick, who's kind of like the douche of the group, right? Yeah. And Gary's just still in love, and, you know, he gets drunk that first night and kind of, you know, David has to deal with him. And I can't believe he lets him drive home drunk. He literally walks him to his car.
This is the 80s. This is drunk driving. This is pre-AIDS. This is, you know, casual sex. This is drug use. This is, you know, unattended kids all over the place at all hours of the day and night, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So, the sex romp happens in the first half of the movie. Eventually they get to the Spanish lady who sleeps with Rick. Oh, and by this time, like Rick and Karen are kind of like dating now, like officially. Yeah. But Karen's a virgin, so, you know, Rick's still just trying to sleep with her the whole time. And Gary has keys to his grandmother's house, who passed away, and no one's living there. So he has access to that house, which Rick wants the keys to it to sleep with Karen, but he's kind of like not letting that happen, you know.
Today we call that cock blocking.
Yeah, he's cock blocking because he likes Karen. And so anyway, they Rick continues to date Karen, and they at this point they're, I guess, which would be a couple weeks in, and Gary gets Rick to kind of go to this lady's house, the Latin sex pot. Mm-hmm. And I guess what Gary was trying to do is to kind of. Was he trying to rat him out? Like, oh, he slept with another girl. Is that what he was trying to do?
I don't know.
I wasn't sure. I'm like, well, if you want Rick to break up with Karen, I don't understand why you're still his friend. Like, just be like, hey, that was a girl I liked. You knew that. What's going on?
Yeah.
But anyway, after that last sex romp, it's when it gets really serious. Eventually, like, they have kind of like a prom thing, like a dance, mm-hmm. and Rick sleeps with Karen. He takes her virginity. They show a bunch of nudity again.
I'm forgetting it. Was this before or after they went to the hooker?
This is, which one was the hooker? Rough. Yeah, you're right. I totally forgot about that.
Cause that to me, I think was where it got really serious.
Yeah. So the Carmella,
three guys.
Carmella happens, right? Mm-hmm. And then the next scene, there's more of you know, this high school and stuff. Mm-hmm. And then the next scene outside of the high school is the hooker scene, which is basically, again, the three guys, Gary, Rick, and David, they go out and they're driving out to get a hooker.
And wow, it really is a kind of a rough scene.
And this is where it gets dark. Cause I mean, they all like proposition her and she's like, yeah, okay, I'll sleep with all of you guys. And I think she charges them 30
each,
right? So she takes them back to like this like abandoned like warehouse. And
it looked like the set from Death Wish 2.
Yes, it did. The layer of that gang.
The back, exactly.
Let's go back to episode one of this, and you'll get that reference. But yeah, it looks like their lair, and she kind of takes Gary. Gary's the first one, mm-hmm. and she takes him to the back, and
berates him,
and Gary kind of is gonna sleep with her, but then it goes to a really wide shot, and you don't know what happens. You don't know if like he kind of like couldn't do it. And it really isn't sure. I think he kind of sleeps. He kind of like has sex with her, right? Like he starts to.
Yeah, he because the punchline is that they all get crabs. So obviously he had some kind of contact.
Yeah, yeah. So and then I guess David's next, and then Rick, and then but it gets really dark, especially like the berating part of it. Like it's just I didn't get like what they were going for. But it was kind of sad. Like, I'm like, whoa, like Gary's like already sad that he lost Karen, but now this hooker's like fucking bringing him down. And then the next day, Gary gets to school. He gets there late. Cause, he's got an itch. In his crotch. And, turns out all of them have crabs.
Well, you know what? It's interesting. As I said, this is pre AIDS, but this film definitely does show the, you know, the talk about STDs and what they mean. And there's actually a kind of funny scene when they go to get the ointment or whatever to get rid of crabs.
Yeah.
Because, you know, today a kid would just probably walk up and be like, yeah, I got crabs.
Yeah. Like,
because we live in that kind of a culture. But well, in 1982.
Their STD is so tamed. It's not even an STD. It's like. But yeah, and the pharmacist like laughs at them. Like he's like, oh, you guys want this thing for the crabs.
Exactly. Have you ever seen that Kids in the Hall sketch with the guy that's got crabs?
No, I haven't.
It's a classic one. It's one of the guys, I think it's Kevin McKinney, and he's pretending to be from Texas and he's buying the crab medication and he's like in the drugstore and he like buys a back scratcher and sticks it down his pants and he gets the ointment and then he hits on the counter girl and she goes and he says, you want to go out, little lady? And she says, no, you got crabs. And he's like, well, that's why I got the ointment. I mean, I mean, there was a time when that was the kind of the attitude.
Yeah. It's like, that's no STD.
Yeah. Oh, we'll take care of that. That's no big deal.
Yeah. But again, this was pre-AIDS. So they all get the crabs and, you know, they get that treated. And then I think the next scene is a scene where Rick takes Karen's virginity.
Yep.
And I think he just takes her to like the dugout, the baseball dugout, I think.
Or someplace.
The clubhouse, like the baseball clubhouse or whatever. The equipment room, I think. And he sleeps with her there. And Gary's actually looking through.
He sees it.
Yeah. You know. And that's kind of sad. Like, that bums me out for some reason. Like, that really bummed me out.
Like, well, the thing about Gary is he's a kid. You know, he's out having fun, but at the same time, he's got a certain amount of mature emotions and investment in his friends and this girl that he's interested in. He just doesn't want to just get laid. He wants to have some kind of connection with somebody, whereas the other guys are just, you know, we're young and we're out having fun.
Yeah, yeah. And then the next few scenes is where it gets really dark. Karen goes to Rick and tells him that she's pregnant, and Rick basically like has broken up with her already.
Yep.
And tells her like, yeah, I don't want to talk to you. Just, you know, that's not my problem.
And it becomes Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
Exactly. And Gary kind of overhears and he goes to her and kind of, you know, finds out what happened, and she tells him that she's pregnant and that, you know, basically that, you know, that was the first time she slept with anybody and all this stuff. And and Gary confronts Rick and they have a fight in the library.
In the library, yes.
Yeah, and And then they go off on their own ways, and Gary tells Karen, like, hey, I'm going to help you. I'm going to help you take care of this, you know. Mm-hmm. And this is where it gets really dark. He takes her to get an abortion.
Yep.
And they tell him it's $250, which is a lot of money now. Like, imagine how much it was back then.
Yeah. Oh, I remember how much it was back then. It was a lot.
And Gary has to, like, grab all his savings, you know, that he's been saving from delivering all these pizzas and stuff. And he even gets a loan from his boss. He gets $100, I think, from his boss. And the worst thing for me in this part of the movie is what he goes and pawns, which is his record player. And I was like, no, why would you do that? I was really upset at this point of the movie. Because I knew what was coming. I knew, like, I hadn't seen this movie, but I knew what was coming. And I'm like, fuck that. Do not pawn your fucking record player. But Gary does it, pawns it, and collects the money and goes and takes it, you know, to the clinic. Yeah. She has an abortion, and they go to stay at Gary's grandma's house, which is empty. And they kind of have, like, a really, like a weird, like, couple, like, married couple type of, like, scene where, like, he made breakfast and, like, you know, like, he kind of believes, like, they're a couple now, you know?
Yeah, well, and it's also that he's taking care of her.
Yeah.
And it's not just that he wants to, you know, he's not expressing just lust for her. It's,
yeah.
It's actual,
like, love.
I guess, love, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And then she wakes up the next day, and he kind of confesses that he loves her, and they kiss. And, you know, you think it's going to be all nice and stuff. And then the next day, I think David again is throwing another party. There's a lot of parties.
Yeah. Well, it was the 80s. That's what you did. I mean,
party all the time.
Exactly.
And
that's what the cocaine was for.
Yeah, you make a great point. And then at this point, he goes to the party and he's all excited because he has this connection with Karen. He helped her. And now she knows he loves her and all this stuff. And he has a present. He goes and he spends more money on her. Like, he already pawned his record player, but he buys her a necklace.
Yeah.
And he's got the necklace in his hand, and he goes to the party, and he asks David, hey, where's Karen? She's like, oh, she's in the kitchen. So he goes to the kitchen and opens the door, and she's making out with Rick again. They're back together. And he is torn. And it's a lingering scene of them making out. And you're like, just stop. He's right just there. Don't punish him anymore. And she kind of, like, her eyes kind of open because she has her eyes closed, and she sees him, and he just kind of runs off. And there's which leads to the end, which is him driving home in his shitty station wagon. Now, you know, I'd imagine is like $300 down.
Yep.
With the necklace.
Record player.
No record player.
If you think about it, I don't know about you, but when I have a little heartbreak, you know, I go home and I turn up the stereo and I blast something awful and loud and angry, you know, a little Negative Approach or whatever. Yeah. But he goes home and he doesn't even have a record player to play.
Well, he goes home and he's reminded again that this girl fucked him over. She made him pawn the fucking record player. And at this point, I'm fucking really upset at her. But I'm like, man, this movie took a dark turn and I like it. Meaning it's just sad. He learned something, you know, like.
Yeah. Well, and that's what he grew up.
Yeah. Yeah.
You can do all the things you're supposed to do and you're still not going to get the girl.
Yes. Yes. And if the point, I guess, of the movie and the point that Gary learned is that if somebody doesn't like you, you basically can't buy their love. Can't buy me love. There you go. It's another.
Yep. And I also think he learns that, you know, friendship, you know, it doesn't always count for as much as you think it does.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it reminds me, you know, I was probably 1989, you know, or 1990. I'm in high school. We're in the parking lot in one of my friend's cars. And, you know, there's like four of us there. My friend turns to me and he says, oh, you know, I'm never going to let a girl come between the four of us. And the next guy turns to us all and says, I'm never going to let a girl come between the four of us. He turns to the next guy and he goes, fuck that. Between three guys and getting laid, I'm getting laid. The guy that said that's the one I'm probably still the best friends with. I'm friends with all those guys to this day, but you know, out of all of them, he's probably the one that I'm still the closest to.
He was honest about it. Yeah,
you know, he was like, you know, this, you know, I'm 16 years old, and you know, that's what it's about right now.
Yeah, this equation of you know, bros before hoes isn't going to work for me.
Yeah, well. You know, if you've seen the movie The Last Days of Disco, there's this whole discussion about the vicious breaking off of the group, because that's kind of the plan, you know? The people break off.
Yeah, the Whitman, right?
What's
the director's name? I'm trying to blank.
Oh, it's Whit Stillman.
Whit Stillman, yeah.
Who you should love, because just look at his last name.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And then my favorite scene, which is the last scene, because the credits start to roll, and it's kind of what I refer to now as the Michael Clayton scene, which is the shot of the credits rolling, but you still see there's still action going. It's still a one continuous shot, and it's Gary in his car, and he's fucking just bawling it. He's just bawling his eyes out, and the credits are rolling. You know, and the music's playing, and it's just heartbreaking. And
it's kind of too bad that this was a flop, because wouldn't you love to see where these characters are today?
Oh yeah, totally.
30 years later, let's do the high school reunion movie and see them 30 years later.
Yeah, like the thing is that this movie is like such a cult thing where you could totally do a sequel to this where it's them as adults and no one would know. You could, you know.
Oh yeah.
Who would see?
Well, you know, I'm a sucker for the high school reunion film, and I need to go back and look at a couple, but I would love to see one that is obviously a, you know, playing homage to, you know, certain what characters were doing in the '80s that we identify with, you know?
Yeah. 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 But that's the end basically. And a great sad ending where people learn something. Cause sometimes, I feel like nowadays, especially with like not even just high school movies, but just like the bromance movies, which is this would be in that category nowadays. And basically it's like, hey, guy is a man child, you know?
Yeah.
Well,
this, like I said, this is somebody actually growing up.
Yeah. Yeah. And somebody learning something, a lesson. I love that.
One of the notes I have is that there's a lot of teenagers acting as if they're adults with that kind of free love, free drugs, this is going to last forever mentality. Yeah. And not to get too socio-political, but this in a lot of ways is Generation X realizing that this lie that was sold to them by the baby boomers is false, and that you are going to get hurt, and that, you know, that it's not all going to work out.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But man, I really enjoyed the whole movie was fun and all until the last half where it got really serious and really sad. And, And just that last shot is what got me. I'm like, man, they got me with this last shot. Like,
yeah,
the whole movie kind of sucked, and this last shot worked for me.
I think that that if it had been all that kind of zany sexcapades for 90 minutes, that it would have lost me.
Yeah.
Or if it had been all this dark, you know, dramatic relationship stuff, that would have started to grind on me at a certain point. So having both in this film, I think, was really interesting, and I think it kind of elevates it above some of the more, you know, some of the more well-known, you know, teen comedies of the period. I think this is, you know, I would go out on the limb and say I think this is probably better than your 16 Candles or your I have a big problem with The Breakfast Club that we don't need to go into, but that there's something about this film that I think elevates it above some of those quote-unquote classic teen comedies of the 80s.
Yeah. I do have to say, before we move on, one last thing. This marked the first appearance. Well, for me, I noticed in the credits the cinematographer was Adam Greenberg. And he's a Polish cinematographer who worked with Bose Davison, the director of this. But he worked with him on the first movie, Lemon Popsicle.
Okay.
Which was the original version of this. And then when he made this Last American Virgin, he brought him over. I think this was his first American film, Adam Greenberg's. But then he went on to direct a bunch of stuff for Canon, the Brecken Company. He did 10 to Midnight, which we'll talk about.
Mm-hmm.
He did a bunch of stuff for them, Over the Brooklyn Bridge. But then, most famously, he was a cinematographer of Terminator and T2.
Oh, okay.
But this marked his first American film coming from Poland. So I was really surprised. I was like, oh wow, I totally recognize that name. Why do I know this name? And then I looked him up, and that was it. So Adam Greenberg's first American film.
So you ready to rate this?
Yes, I totally am. What did you give it? So we do Letterboxd rating. If you don't know what Letterboxd is, it's a really cool social media film, like a film community where it's like Facebook without any fucking updates. Is just watching movies, rating them, and mm-hmm. reviewing them. And if you want to join us, it's free. You could join now, or you could, you know, donate some money to them, which would be great. And you could be you can go pro, but it's Letterboxd without the last E. So letterboxd.com. And you could join us there. You could find me by my name, Ricardo, and you could find you're under Eric, right? Eric Peterson.
Probably, but I use my email handle, which is IRENZERO, which is
how
you find me everywhere. But we'll have links in that.
Yeah,
stuff,
yeah. So. We'll have the links under like the show notes and stuff to this episode. But yeah, join us there and you'll see all our ratings and stuff. But what did you give this? From half a star to 5 stars. What did you give?
I gave it 3.5.
Exactly my rating as well. Yeah, it would have been much less if it wasn't for that last like serious sad tone change. But yeah, it almost a 4. Like I flirted with giving it a 4, but I'm like, no. There are more films later on this Canon Film Group list that are going to get a 4 and a 5.
And like I said, this is definitely worth your time to take a look at, especially if you like films from this time period about teenagers.
Exactly. All right, so then that moves us forward to our next film, which is that
a totally different film, but yet still kind of, you know, interestingly relevant.
Exactly. I just thought of that, and I just watched this last night, so it's fresh in my mind. We're talking about 1983's That Championship Season.
Is it 82 or 83? Because the listing on Netflix. I'm sorry, Netflix. On Wikipedia says it's 82.
82? So. Then it's 82 then. Then I must
That's
have read
fine.
It wrong. Yeah, yeah. I think it might have been made in 82, but released in 83.
Okay. Yeah, so. Well, actually, the release date, according to the Canon page, is January of 83.
There
so.
You go. That's why. It was made in 82, but released in 83. So tell us a little bit about that championship season.
So it's set in Scranton, Pennsylvania, and it is the story of set in 1983, and it's the 25th anniversary of the 1957 film war high school basketball team won the state championship, and it's about several of the team members coming together to a party and to celebrate their coach, who was played by Robert Mitchum, and kind of to look back on their lives since that glory moment of being these, you know, teenage champions. And it's based on a play, and it's fairly obviously based on a play because there is basically there's a couple of opening shots, but the majority of the action takes place in a single house, and it's very dialogue heavy.
Yeah.
Stars Robert Mitchum as their coach, but Martin Sheen, Stacey Keach, Bruce Dern, and Paul Sorvino, who is probably the least known of these actors, but his daughter is Mira Sorvino.
Yeah, well, I think people would know Paul.
They might.
Yeah, he's
probably the least marquee name.
Yeah, of these guys. Yeah, yeah.
He's a character actor more than anything.
But Paul Sorvino, everybody knows him. He's the boss in Goodfellas.
Oh yeah, and he's also in The Rocketeer.
Yeah.
He's got that great line, you know, I might be a criminal, but I'm 100% American.
Yeah. and I made the mistake. I'll confess here on the podcast. I'll look like a fool.
Okay.
I rented it I was streaming it on Amazon. I'm sorry.
Okay.
And the credits start, and I'm like, Paul Sorvino directed by Paul Sorvino. What the fuck am I watching? And I'm like, this movie doesn't. Why is Vincent D'Onofrio in this movie? It was the remake of it, the 90s version of it. And I'm like, and then I went and I searched it, and I'm like, oh man, I'm watching the wrong one. I paid to. So make sure you watch the right one. Don't make the mistake I did. Just blind buy it.
Yeah, I actually got this disc from Netflix when I watched it.
But be careful with that. There are two. There's this one, the 82 version, and then there's one, I want to say like 94 or 90 something. But that one is actually directed by Paul Sorvino.
Yeah.
But yeah, this movie, so again, just watched last night. Pretty heavy movie. And this is a movie that kind of produced, again, all these movies produced by the Cannon Film Group. And this is a movie that kind of elevated their production company.
Yeah.
If only for this movie. it really made they released a legitimately great film and gave them more credit, you know. And really kind of they went from just releasing, you know, B movies to releasing this great. Would this be considered an art house film?
I think it would. I mean, it's based on a play, and it's got some, you know, it's got some heavyweight actors in it. Mm-hmm. Who, this isn't a paycheck film for them at all. Mm-mm. This is the film where they get to act
they really kind of bring it. And I, again, like you said, besides those very few like scenes in the beginning,
yeah,
it's all a play. It's all inside a house, and you know, it's all takes place in one location. And it's written. The play is Jason Miller, who everybody probably knows. As what's his name? He's in The Exorcist, and he plays Father. Oh man, Adam Scott is gonna yell at me for not knowing this by memory. He plays the young priest, the young father in The Exorcist.
Damien Karras.
Yes,
right?
Father Damien. Yes. Oh man,
I had to look that up. I'll be honest.
Yeah, he plays Father Damien in The Exorcist, and he won a Pulitzer for this play. Mm-hmm. He was actually on the set of The Exorcist when they told him, hey, you want a Pulitzer for your play. And I think Friedkin was going to direct this film.
That would have been interesting.
Yeah, and for some reason it fell through. But I think that's how Friedkin got involved, because he was on the set of The Exorcist, because he directed The Exorcist. And I think he said, hey, they're thinking of making my play into a movie. Would you want to be interested? And he said, yeah. And then I think at the last moment, it was scheduling problems. And actually, Jason Miller stepped in and he directed it. And this was the only really, he had done TV stuff and plays, but really this is the only film he kind of, like feature film, he directed. After this, he didn't direct anything else. So I was surprised, because he did a pretty decent job. Like I had no complaints about the directing in this film. It was a really good job. But the movie starts off and it's like a town fair, right?
Well, it's Bruce Dern's character is the mayor who's running for re-election.
Yeah,
and you know it seems like he's kind of coasted on this this legendary basketball championship hero moment that's catapulted him into the the top echelon of the the Scranton, which is a decent sized city in Pennsylvania. So we're not talking even a second city. We're talking, we're talking a good sized city that's way down the rung. I mean, it's not state capital. It's not a major city, but it is of some note.
Yeah, yeah. And the first thing I thought about when I heard Scranton, I'm like, I wonder if any of these people are Jim's dad from The Office. That's the first thing.
I'll admit I know very little about The American Office because I've never watched more than one or two episodes.
Oh man, but yeah, the Office basically takes place in the same town.
Yes,
but,
I know that it's the same location. But yeah,
So they're Bruce Dern, who's the mayor, gives the city a gift, which is Tilly, the elephant.
An elephant, yes. I mean, can you think of a bigger metaphor for what, just create? I mean, it's like this is like Springfield, right? This is this is a Simpsons plot. Come
exactly,
on.
Exactly. And Tilly lasts like about, is it like a week or something?
Something like that.
Yeah, it's like a week, and then it drops dead.
Yep.
And they all kind of... I'll say that all the guys, they're still friends, except for Martin. So Martin Sheen's character, Tom Daly, mm-hmm. and Stacey Keach, James Daly, they're brothers.
Yep.
But Martin Sheen's character he's not in the town. He's kind of, he comes in just for this thing.
Yep.
And, but the rest of the guys, Bruce Dern, Stacey, and Paul Sorvino, they're still friends. They still live in this town.
And they've all become powerful in the town in their own way.
Yeah, exactly.
You have the mayor, you got the high school principal, and Paul Sorvino's character is very wealthy.
Like, is he like a real estate guy, kind of?
I didn't really pick up on exactly what he is.
They don't specify, but he's kind of he has dealings with Bruce Dern, who's a mayor, and they're kind of in cahoots. But Stacey Keach just kind of become Bruce Dern's kind of he runs his campaign. And I gotta tell you, as soon as this movie was okay until mm-hmm. Martin Sheen steps in and he just kicks ass. I love Martin Sheen. And one of my favorite scenes is a funny scene when Tilly's dead and Tilly the elephant is dead mm-hmm. and they're trying to dispose of his body.
Yes.
just an elephant.
What are you gonna do? I mean, come on.
So Paul Sorvino's character decides he's gonna like bury it in this like pit that he has in one of his like construction sites, and Paul Sorvino hires a bunch of his family members to deal with this construction site. So they're all not the most qualified. Mm-hmm. So there's a guy like moving around this crane that's carrying the dead body of the elephant. And the news crew shows up, and he's trying to. Paul Sorvino's like yelling at this guy, like mm-hmm. hurry up and drop it, because he doesn't want them to film the elephant. And he drops the elephant, and it just hits floor. It misses the pit completely. It's one of the. I can't believe like that. There's such a funny scene in like such a movie that gets really really fucking serious.
Well, the whole thing with the elephant, it's a metaphor. It's this great, wonderful thing that dies and then comes kind of an embarrassment and then gets kind of kicked around a little bit to even more embarrassing levels.
Yeah, yeah. So then I guess they all kind of meet up with the coach, which is played by Robert Mitchum.
Wow.
Which,
and, there's only one role of Robert Mitchum's that I can think of where he was – better as an actor. I mean, there were other films he was in that he had more charisma and mm-hmm. presence and mm-hmm. that kind of thing. But the only thing besides this, especially later in his career, that I think he was this good and was Friends of Eddie Coyle, which to me is pinnacle. But
Friends of Eddie Coyle, I'm waiting to do like a con man or a heist. I think we did heist.
Okay.
But Eddie Coyle is it's up there for me. Like
it's classic. But yeah, this is that level of Mitchum. Once again, he's also not cashing a paycheck, which he was known to do in this time period in the early 80s.
Yeah.
You know, he made a lot of TV movies and he was solid in them, but this was, you know, he brings it.
Yeah, he really does. And you know what? I had forgotten that Robert Mitchum was the voiceover in the movie Tombstone. I totally forgot about that until I heard him talk. And I'm like, oh my God, that's who it was the whole time. It was Robert Mitchum. I didn't know who it was, but I figured it out finally. And then, by the way, before I forget, this movie was composed by Bill Conti, the composer of Rocky. Another little trivia fact. But yeah, this was a solid like movie that was, like you said, at the time it was an art house film. You know, it all took place in one, and it's kind of still. There's some moments where they're really still, and of course it's an '80s movie, so someone's got to be doing cocaine.
Yes,
and in this movie it's Paul Sorvino.
Well, you know, and this is what ties into Last American Virgin. It's about a group of friends who, at first, they seem like they're lighthearted friends who have known each other forever, and maybe they have, but as time goes on, the darker nature and the roles of this friendship, you know, what's the role that each person in this group fills, or, you know, if you want to look at it as the position on the team, you know, they kind of fall into that, even though in a lot of ways they're all chafing against being slotted into those roles.
Yeah. And I mean, it's a very, it's a really well made kind of by the numbers kind of play, you know, which translates to it's a decent movie. I had no complaints, but I really thought this was not going to be a good movie going in, and I was surprised again, like Last American Virgin.
Yeah.
Like, wow, like this is a pretty cool movie. I can't believe this is part of the Canon Film Group Productions. So Martin Sheen is kind of the alcoholic of the group.
Yeah.
And Bruce Dern, he's a mayor, but he's kind of a little corrupt. Like you hear from his friends that, you know, there's payoffs and stuff like that.
But you know what? At the same time, he seems to be corrupt for the town.
Yes.
As opposed to completely for himself.
Yeah, it's whatever it takes to get this town going forward. That's his mission. And then Stacey Keach has his Stacey Keach kind of throws everybody under the bus.
Yeah.
He tells Bruce Dern that Paul Sorvino's sleeping with his wife, which, you know, he is.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like these group of friends who on the surface you think like, oh, it's been years, but they're the same old people. But, you know, you see how flawed they are. And
secrets come out.
Yeah. And it's basically, you know, them in a house revealing secrets to each other, discovering stuff, and just great performances, you know. Martin Sheen is amazing.
Solid. And, you know, and let me throw something else out there, which is the generational aspect.
Yeah.
So if these guys were the state basketball champions in 1957, that means they're members of what's known as the silent generation, which is the generation that came before the boomers, after the greatest generation, and they were largely the parents of Generation X, and there was a lot of disillusionment within this generation. A lot of, they felt really trapped between their parents their older aunts and uncles in the boomer generation, because they were another small generation, because they were born during the Depression and then during World War II. And a lot of them were, you know, they played the game and they were part of the quote unquote conformist 50s. And then, you know, as especially into the early 80s, they were being trampled by the boomers.
Yeah.
You know, they were, these are the people that were losing their jobs because they were too old and too expensive. And, you know, there's a lot of those pressures of having been these champions, and then their lives hadn't necessarily taken off the way that they had thought they would. And they're still playing a lot of these, you know, like sleeping with each other's wives kind of games.
And they're holding on to some like past glory that's not with them anymore. Overall, again, I enjoyed the film. It's one of the ones you should definitely check out. Usually we'll tell you like No, this is the one you could skip, but these first two, definitely check out.
Most definitely.
And I definitely recommend it. And so let's get into the rating.
Okay.
Again, from half to five stars, what do you give it?
I gave it 3.5.
Yeah. I give it 3, just because I liked the previous movie a lot more, and I had to give it a higher rating. But yeah, it's a solid movie. I would definitely recommend you see it. And I only saw the beginning of the remake. Mm-hmm. But I'm curious to find out like how that came about, because in that one Paul Sorvino is now directing, so I'm curious to see. Yeah. But Stacy Keach, I was surprised to see, you know, how slim he was, you know, in the '80s.
Well, if you go back and you look, I mean, he was, well, famously he was doing a lot of cocaine. But he was playing Mike Hammer on TV, and he had done a lot of interesting roles in the 70s especially. So yeah, I think he was in the Blue Centurion, which is definitely worth a look.
Yeah.
If you like LA police stuff.
Oh yeah. Yeah. So again, check that out. A definite recommendation for that
most
movie.
Most definitely.
That Championship Season, directed by Jason Miller. All right. That brings us to what year is
Treasure
this
of the Four Crowns.
Treasure of the Four Crowns from 1983. This was most definitely one of the hardest movies to get through.
Really?
Yeah. I lost patience for it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, it's not available on DVD, and I had to watch it on YouTube.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. So it's available in its entirety on YouTube. So
yes.
But I think it's one of the ones we did, even though it's not available on DVD, we did this because I wanted to get into the 3D aspect of it. You
okay.
know? The fact that 3D was, well, 3D is kind of in, and I at least wanted to talk about an old 3D movie. But tell us a little bit about Treasure of the Four Crowns.
Okay, so Soldier of Fortune J.T. Stryker has been hired to assemble a group of professional thieves to retrieve gems hidden inside two of the remaining four mystical crowns. Basically, this is inspired by Raiders of the Lost Ark, the whole Indiana Jones notion. It's a heist film. It's guys going on a mission. It's people having to figure out where things, you know, were left in the past. And there's a little bit of James Bond in there, because you have some kind of, you know, this mountain fortress like in For Your Eyes Only. And then there's also this weird cult aspect that's really much – really kind of thing you saw a lot in the late 60s and into the 70s. Films like Harper with I'm totally blanking on his name. Paul Newman, that dealt with the kind of the cult mania that was going on in the 70s. So, it's an adventure film, and it's, you know, it's kind of low budget. It's Italian. I believe it's Italian, and it's shot in 3D. I do remember this playing in the theaters. I did not see it in the theaters. I did want to, but we did not get to go. It's kind of globetrotting as well. You know, there's stuff in Rome and in New York State and kind of all over the place.
Yeah, yeah.
So, there's the gathering the team together and then, you know, the guys on a mission thing going on. So.
And this was the actor, Tony Anthony, came up with a story for this movie. And this was his last movie. He did TV after this, but this was his last like feature film that he ever did. So, I just had a hard time getting through it. I think my problem was the fact that I was watching it on YouTube. I think that's the big part of it. I think maybe if I'd been watching it on my big screen, I would have maybe enjoyed it a little more.
See, because I actually really enjoyed this film a lot.
Really?
And I thought it was a fun romp. It was definitely of its time. I was definitely in the mindset of this is not great art. This is, you know, this is an Italian rip-off film. Mm. I think it had some great shots of Rome in the time period. And it actually made me want there to be a series of those. The film, I think we talked about before, Los Angeles Plays Itself. Mm-hmm. I want a Rome Plays Itself. I want a London Plays Itself. I want a New York Plays Itself. I want a Stockholm Plays Itself. I want a film that's a documentary or a video essay showing these cities and these locations through the years that they've been filmed. So give me pictures of the streets of Rome circa you know, the 30s when they were making films and the 40s when they were making films. And I want to see the 80s Rome and I want to see the 90s Rome.
Yeah.
So I actually liked it. There was some great costuming stuff, you know, very much of the era. You know, like I have a note that he was wearing an orange jacket and tan pants. I mean, that was very much trying to be this is what adventurers wear.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's lots of stuff coming at the camera. That's where the 3D aspect comes in.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You get bats and snakes and, you know, animals and all that kind of stuff.
And this movie, I think, was also going to be a series, kind of like the Indiana Jones type, like, a series. But again, all these movies didn't do very well, so no sequels for them. I think the next one was going to be like a Space Odyssey, if I'm not mistaken. So that would have been interesting. At least, you know, would have been a different setting. But it's just I think it's the fact that I couldn't watch it on my big screen is what kind of deterred me to it. But I mean, it's cheesy. It's a movie where some movies that take place that are old movies. Mm-hmm. I don't. Some people laugh like when the phone rings and it's an old timey phone. People laugh, but I think and I think it's. You kind of, I tend not to do that, but for these movies, you have to laugh. It's that type of movie.
Oh, yeah.
It's a funny, cheesy 80s movie. So,
well, and also this is an Italian film. And
yes,
in the
yes.
70s and in the early 80s, the Italians were masters of ripping off and just mangling American films. I mean, horror films and whatnot. And sometimes they came up with some really great stuff and sometimes they came up with some really bad stuff. To me, I think this is, like I said, I think this is a fun romp that I think deserves a DVD release at least. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's something about this film, at least for me, that I thought made it worth the watch.
So you're going to definitely recommend it?
Yeah, I am. Okay. The film has its flaws, and mm-hmm. you know, this is where. Like that championship season is an art film that with great performances and dialogue, this is a watchable romp that is fun and that, you know, harkens back to an era of adventure films where they were trying to remake the adventure film for what was then a modern audience.
Yeah, no, totally. And I feel like we're going to get to a couple of adventure films like with maybe Chuck Norris later on.
Yeah.
And those I feel like this was a little bit before my time and I want to say that's the case and I just couldn't get into it, but you're definitely recommending it. I'm going to go ahead and say pass. But that's where we differ. That's why there's two of us and not just one of us.
Well, and one of the things I'll say is this is total MST3K fodder. I mean, this is a film that you could sit around with your friends and just riff on.
And this is a good drinking game movie, you know?
Yes, it is. Every time something comes at the screen, take a shot.
Yes, yes. But yeah, I would be curious to see like a really like cool like DVD version of it where you know it's in 3D where it was the red and the blue.
Yep.
I would enjoy that and it would be a great drinking game. So again in this one we are parting ways and Eric is saying see it. And I'm going to say, you could skip it.
Okay.
But what did you rate it?
I'm going to give it 3 stars, actually, because I, you know, it's not quality, but I thought it was fun and I had a good time with it.
I'm going to go with 1 star.
Okay.
Until I see a DVD or Blu-ray copy of it. I honestly think that's one of the big problems I had. That okay. I'm just not, I don't know how people watch. I've seen people on the street watching movies on their iPhone. And all these movies, now, like all the Blu-rays you get nowadays come with a digital copy. And I like that for some reason, but I've yet to see a movie on my iPhone.
I've never watched any of them on my iPod.
Yeah.
However, I was recently on another podcast that is yet to be released where we were talking about a serial, you know, like a Saturday afternoon serial from the 40s. Mm-hmm. And those are like 20, you know, 13, 14 minutes long each chapter.
Yeah.
And I did actually watch some of those on my iPod, you know, the kind of widescreen format.
Yeah.
And that was fine. But I can't see watching like
– like sitting there for 2 hours and watching.
Exactly. That. You know, 15 minutes on my lunch break I can do.
Yeah, yeah. And I like TV shows like that are just 30 minutes.
Yeah.
It's fine and all. But, you know, I feel like movies like this, especially, and we need to watch them on a bigger screen. And I tell you what, if this movie were playing like at the New Beverly here in L.A., you know, the this great old like theater where they still play 35, I would definitely go and see it just to see the 3D, you know, in effect. And
like
all
I said,
that
I think this is something that needs to be seen with an audience, and it's total MST3K fodder.
I totally agree. So there you go. The one star for me and 3.5, you said?
No, I said three.
Three. I gave an extra half. Three for Eric. So there you go. Treasure of the Four Crowns, 1983. That takes us to 1983s, right?
Yep.
1983's 10 to Midnight with a little actor.
Charlie Bronson coming back.
Charlie Bronson, exactly. We talked about him last episode with Death Wish 2.
Yeah,
and he's gonna be we're gonna be talking a lot of Charlie Bronson in the next coming episodes because he makes a lot of appearances in the canon films, but this marks our second time we're talking about him, and this movie directed by J. Lee Thompson, and give us a little synopsis and then we'll talk about it.
It's about a police detective who is investigating a psychosexual killing that's kind of in the 80s slasher, but also a little bit in the kind of Zodiac camp. And he figures out who it is, but because of the system, he can't put the guy away, and things just kind of go crazy from there.
Yeah. And
this is a truly, truly crazy film.
Yeah, but yeah, I mean, it's definitely it only could have been made in the 80s.
Yes, most definitely.
Interesting fact, Charles Bronson was 61 years old when he made this movie.
Yeah.
That's incredible. You know, like what I guess Robert De Niro is still making movies, but I'm saying like this is kind of here it first with two genres. It first with the action thriller and a horror movie. It definitely gets into horror elements.
Yes, it does.
But yeah, I was surprised to find out that Charles Bronson was 61 years old and, you know, he's still in the force. But yeah, and I think this is where he started to get plastic surgery.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah. And so we start off in which feels like a weird sequel to the Death Wish movies. Doesn't it? Like, it just feels like it falls into those type of... I wonder if it's written by the same... based off the same novels, maybe.
No, it's not.
It's not?
It's not.
Yeah, it just... Maybe it's that 80s vibe that I'm getting, but it felt definitely like I felt when
no,
I watched Death
definitely.
Wish.
No, definitely. And Bronson's presence was so... At this point in his career, was so much about Death Wish.
Yeah.
And so much about these kind of tough cop action films that he had fallen into in this time period.
And I'm not sure about, I maybe you know the answer to this, but did Charles Bronson have, like, so he had that, you know, he had that, a great career, you know, with like The Great Escape and all those great movies. But then did he kind of, was this his kind of second coming or?
Yeah, it was, right? So, you know, we were just talking with Treasure of the Four Crowns about the Italian films.
Yeah.
And one of the things that happened in Italian films in the 1970s was they basically reinvented or gave their own stamp to the horror film with the Giallo movement, which, you know, Dario Argento and those films.
Yeah.
And then also there's the Eurocrime movement, which is just now seeming to be rediscovered, where they would make these – you know, basically, you know, kidnapping films or revenge films or their version of Yojimbo, but with their own kind of take. And they would bring kind of fading U.S. name stars over, you know, Jack Palance, or they would bring over, you know, Charles Bronson or Woody Strode or character actors. And they would put them as stars in these films. And that kind of, in a lot of ways, you know, there was like a feedback loop to the States where – the Italians were making these crazy, classy, outrageous, you know, sometimes arty films, and the American actors would go over there and get their paycheck and make the film and come back. And some of those films came back and were very influential. So if you look at like John Carpenter's Halloween, that was definitely influenced by what the Italians were doing. So by the early 80s, you know, people like Charles Bronson, who had gone to Italy to make these films, and those films had been sold all over the world, maybe not the United States, but they started to have cachet outside of the United States. So in a company like Canon could make a Bronson film and sell it throughout Asia, sell it throughout Europe, sell it throughout Africa, and, you know, the United States. So we started seeing these people like Bronson have a bit of a comeback.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I enjoy some of these films. Like, we talked about Death Wish 2, and it's just, like, really dark and, like, gritty and really interesting topics. Like, because this guy, like, he's got a weird, he gave me the killer in this, played by Gene Davis. The character's name is Warren Stacy. He has like an American Psycho feel to it, you know, like a Bateman feel to him. And he kills all his victims while nude, which tripped me out. Like, it just, like, I was like, what's going on? Why is this guy naked all the time? And it was definitely an interesting movie, because you know who the killer is, and Charles Bronson knows who the killer is. But because of the evidence and stuff, it's more about... I think how I viewed it was more of a character piece for Charles Bronson's character, Leo Kessler, about what he's willing to do to, you know, to get this guy convicted.
I also think that it's a product of the time, because he's the old school cop, and then he's partnered with the new school cop, played by Andrew Stevens, and it's the classic, you know, the old gruff cop that we used to do this back in the day, and the young cop was like, no, we have to do this way now because times have changed. And you know, and even with the killer, who's talking about, well, I'm insane, you know, where in the past, you know, somebody went and murdered, you know, 20 people, you lock them up and throw away the key, but by the 80s there was the, well, you know, they had a bad childhood, and they're they're bipolar, and they're not responsible for their actions. And so there's a lot of that kind of tension in the film. It's this, once again, a generational tension between, you know, the people that are now responsible for enforcing the law.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's also this very 80s, you know, talking about him being naked, there's this body obsession. The clothes that he wears are very particular, and they're very crisp. And, you know, him being naked, you know, he's in shape and all of those kinds of things.
Yeah, yeah. And that's what gave me the Jason, was it Patrick Bateman feel to it.
Like, yeah.
Just really kind of, and I mean, American Psycho is based, it takes place in the 80s. So it even gave me more of that feel, you know?
Yeah. And that was part of the culture, though. It was this, you know, everything has to be perfect and crisp and up to date. And, you know, when we were talking about Last American Virgin, and there, you know, the idea that there was stuff left over from the past, definitely in something like American Psycho, or even to this film to a certain degree, it was all about what is going on right now, and that's more important than the way we used to do things or how it used to be.
Yeah, yeah. And this marks like the fourth time that the director Thompson and Charles Bronson worked together. They had worked on three other projects before this, but J. Lee Thompson, most famously, well, what I recognize him from was the original Cape Fear.
Yep.
At which I was
surprised. Once again, another great Robert Mitchum role.
Exactly. And I never noticed that, how you're mentioning how these actors had a second run on their career by making all these movies overseas. I had never really paid attention to that until like now. Like, I'm like, wow, that makes total sense. It makes total sense. Like, even Cape Fear itself, like, it feels like that's what that is. So yeah, this movie, Jason the Killer, who kills in the nude, and I do like how it flirts with the horror genre. I was really digging that part. Like, I wish, it definitely reminded me of. I wonder if this was one of the movies that that like Fincher was kind of influenced by in making what's it called, the
Zodiac.
Zodiac, yeah, because it had like. It was scary at times, and then but it was a procedural, you know, it was a cop movie.
Yeah, well, and there's also a lot of psychobabble in this. There's that one point where he talks about the killer, the knife has to be his penis.
Oh yeah.
And what else? Yeah, this has some of the buddy cop tropes that we would come to know.
Yeah. And the ending really surprised me. Like, the ending of how, like... spoiler alert. I'm about to spoil something really big.
Okay.
He just shoots the guy at the end. He just shoots him in the head.
Yep. Come on. That's frontier justice, right?
Yeah. I was totally surprised. I'm like, all right, well, this is the part where, you know, so I was like, fuck it. The cops are coming. I don't give a shit. I want to shoot you in the head. I was really, really surprised. But yeah, overall, like, really enjoyable. Great, you know.
Yeah. You know, we talked a little bit about Zodiac. There's also a scene where Charles Bronson has a daughter in this film who's going to nursing school.
Yeah.
And this was the point. I think this was the end of the time period where you went to nursing school by going to a hospital and being trained to be a nurse. And by this point, they were transitioning to you went to college and got a nursing degree.
Yeah, I was wondering about that. I'm glad you brought it up because I was like, why are all these girls kind of like in a dorm? Like, what's going on here?
My mother was an RN, and when she got her degree in the her nursing certification in the 60s, she went to the hospital where she was trained, and they had a dorm there, and they lived there, and they did, you know, they did nursing work and they did their classroom work, and when they were done with the program after however long, they became registered nurses, and that's how it was. That was in the 60s. You know, by the 80s, it had started to change.
Yeah, that really kind of surprised me. I always have to look things up sometimes when I'm like looking at an older movie. I'm like, why are these people doing this? But now that makes total sense.
Well, and we were talking about the dorm. There's a scene where the killer tries, you know, he basically attacks a bunch of nurses in the dorm.
Yeah.
Which is actually a callback to the Richard Speck murders in Chicago, where he killed, I think it was 8 nurses who were living together in a house.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah.
And then Ted Bundy also, and I'm not sure when this happened in the timeline, if this was before or after this movie, Ted Bundy actually attacked a sorority in Florida and killed a bunch of girls there.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is dealing with not just Zodiac, but other serial killers of note.
Yeah, yeah. I did recognize that. I'm like, oh, this sounds familiar. And you've seen it in a bunch of movies too that kind of replicate that storyline.
But it's really, really stylishly shot.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
There's some humor in it. It's got that 80s LA sleaze going on.
Yeah. And this again was shot by Adam Greenberg, which I've been noticing that, like, the ones I really like, I'm like, I go and look at the cinematographer, I'm like, oh, he's a famous guy, I recognize this guy. So definitely really shot really well. You definitely, they capture some of the movies that take place at night. It's hard to capture, like, the city.
Yeah.
Which I keep going back to Michael Mann's Collateral, how I love how he captured, you know, L.A. And this, he definitely, even though it's on film, I love how it's shot, and you know, some of the locations I recognize and stuff. So, and I was surprised to see, I didn't know Wilford Brimley was in it as the captain. So I was like, whoa, this is pre-diabetes.
Yep.
This
would have been after The Thing, but before that TV show he did.
Yeah. He's if you're like me, you suffer from diabetes. I enjoyed it. I enjoy Wilford Brimley in anything he's in. The Battle for Endor or Absence of Malice, anything. I can always use a peppering of Wilford Brimley.
He's a solid character actor.
Yeah,
that's for sure.
And I don't know what it is about him, but every time he's on screen, like, I just love it. I just like hearing him talk. I think it's his voice.
Yeah. He's got a presence, that's for sure.
Yeah, yeah. And then I was also surprised to see Jeffrey Lewis in this.
Yeah,
another character actor who you recognize right away.
Oh yeah.
But yeah, overall solid. Loved it. Loved the guy who played his partner, the young, you know, by the books kind of kid,
who went on to make, I believe, a lot of erotic thrillers in the 90s.
Yeah. But yeah, overall great. Let me see. You want to go into ratings now?
Sure. Go ahead.
Again, from half to 5 stars, I gave this one 3. Okay. 3 stars.
I gave it 3.5. I was talking earlier about the giallos, the Italian horror films, and it just definitely had that kind of feel with the knife and the way it was shot and the atmosphere. So that kind of knocked it up just about a half star above what you gave it. But yeah, definitely recommend. This is also a film that the Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema podcast has covered in the past and spoken highly of.
Yeah.
So I definitely recommend, if you want to hear more about this film, check out their much more in-depth discussion of it.
And do they do one movie, one episode?
They do two movies usually, okay, an episode. Sometimes they do three.
Okay.
And then sometimes they do special episodes. But typically it's they talk about what they have been watching, and then they talk about two films.
Nice. So check that episode out if you want more to know more about 10 to Midnight.
And I think they talk about Bronson and the dildo in that episode. So
no, I have to listen to it. All right, so that brings us to 1983's Hercules, with another Italian film, right?
Yeah.
With starring Lou Ferrigno.
Yes.
And he dubbed his voice on this movie.
Well, the Italians dub everything.
Yeah.
But
yeah. Let's see. I'm pulling up my notes. This movie is really ultra cheesy, but
yes,
I liked it.
See, now I was bored stiff, to be honest. I mean, it wore thin. Now, I did see this movie at the drive-in back in about 1984 or 1985 with my family.
I still gave it – I won't spoil how many stars I gave it to the end, but okay. I still gave it a really low rating. But
okay.
I sat through, you know, perfectly fine. But the Treasure of the Four Crowns, I couldn't get through. But this,
okay,
was just so bad that it was good.
Oh, it was, yeah. I mean, there was a certain amount of enjoyment, but like I said, it just, as it wore on, it was just losing me.
Yeah.
And that could be that I was just not in the mood to be watching it that day, but yeah, it, you know, the plot synopsis, it's kind of a retelling of the Hercules stories. And there's this wizard who uses science to take over the world or something. You know.
Yeah, and basically it's Hercules fighting these, like, weird robots.
Yeah. I mean, the stop motion was cool, and the robots were cool, and the monsters and, you know, the cheesy sets were kind of fun, but it just went on for way too long for me.
Yeah, yeah. And now I know that it was nominated for, like, it was in the fourth Golden Raspberry Awards. Did that become the Razzies or no?
Yes.
Oh, it did. It became the Razzies, right? So yeah, it was nominated for a Razzie in its fourth year. But yeah, this movie is really cheesy. Stars Lou Ferrigno, and it throws you off because you're hearing another actor dub his voice.
Yep.
So I'm like, whoa, this feels really weird. But surprised to find out, and we'll probably talk about it in a later episode, there's a sequel to this movie.
Yeah, there is. Cool. I mean, it's on the disc that you can get from Netflix. Yeah.
Called The Adventures of Hercules. Which,
yeah,
I think we might be fine if we skip it, because it's more of the same thing.
Yeah, you know, one of the other things that these Italian films were notorious for was making basically two or three films out of the same footage. They would bring people over and they'd film a whole bunch of crap, and then they'd just kind of edit it together.
But yeah, just really cheesy. It felt also like it ripped off, you know, Conan the Barbarian a little bit at some points. And so, I'd go, even though I thought it was really cheesy and stuff, it's a good drinking game movie. But besides that, I think it's one of the ones you could skip, you know?
Yeah. I would say, once again, this is MST3K fodder.
Yeah.
This is, you know, see it in a group with a group of friends, you know, have it on in the background at a party kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, this, I believe it's PG. So, I mean, this might hold the attention of maybe preteens.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
But like you said, it's a great movie. Like, if you're having a party, no one's actually watching TV and everyone's talking and you know?
Yeah.
This is a good movie to have on in the background, because I love these type of movies, because when you're playing this at a party, you'll be talking to somebody and they won't be paying attention to you at a certain point. And you're like, what are they looking at? And then you look over and it's Lou Ferrigno fighting this robot. And he's supposed to be Hercules.
I mean, the special effects are really cheesy and fun, but I mean, this is not the film that you're going to sit down and watch. And yeah.
Yeah. So what is your rating for this movie?
I gave this film 1.5 stars.
How you were generous. I gave it 1 star.
Okay.
And again, like I said, good for a party. You probably don't need to see this movie.
Nobody needs to see this movie. This is, like I said, throw it on in the background and call it good.
Yeah, yeah. Say that you saw it. All right, so I think that concludes the movies for this episode.
Yep.
Stay tuned. Maybe at the end of next month, we'll release the next episode. We'll probably end up talking about 4 or 5 other movies, which will probably be, let's see, we'll start off with Revenge of the Ninja, which is most a definitely. Sequel. So we'll do Revenge of the Ninja, Over the Brooklyn Bridge, Breaking, and maybe we'll do one more, either Exterminator 2 or
Bolero.
Yeah, yeah. I think we'll do those. And so stay tuned. And it's gonna get really interesting, especially when we get to American Ninja. All right. So hopefully, you know, coming up, we'll have some other guests, you know, podcasters. We'll have some hope. I'm hoping that once we get to the later 80s, mm-hmm. we're going to get some guests that have worked on the movies. Hopefully, you know, fingers crossed, but hopefully you're enjoying these as much as we are. I'm enjoying rewatching these movies, in some cases discovering them. Like again, I can't push, the Last American Virgin enough. I really kind of, that was a gem, and it's definitely going to be in my discoveries of 2013 episode. But again, thanks for listening. And you could follow Eric at
I'm on the Facebook. You can find me over at the film podcast page. I'm over there, and you can follow me on Twitter at IRENZERO.
Yeah.
And, see all the movies I'm watching over there.
Yeah, and you could find us again on Letterboxd, and all the links to all that is on our website at thefilmpodcast.com. You could go to click on the gang, and Eric and I, our pages will pull up, and that has links to everything, to our Facebook, to our Twitter, to our Letterboxd accounts. So go there, and you'll find all the links. But you could find me on Twitter at Ricardo, ULTRERAS. You could find the podcast at The Film Podcast on Twitter. And so check that out and stay tuned for new episodes. And that's about it. So until next time, hey, have a good week.
Party all the time.
Exactly.